Today in Karbala, the roaring sea of mourners, clad in black and chanting Ya Hussein, is not afraid of the dastardly terrorists who have threatened to target them with bombs and missiles. A testimony in this regard is the presence of women, children, toddlers in prams, the elderly in wheelchairs, and even physically handicapped persons moving slowly but surely on their disabled feet with whatever strength that is left in their worn-out bodies. The eyes of the world are glued to this greatest ever annual congregation, which is remarkably disciplined, cognizant of the omnipresent Creator, obedient to the instructions of the Prophet, brimming with love for the Ahlul Bayt, punctual in performing the obligatory 5 times a day ritual prayers, observing hygienic rules, and overflowing with fraternal affection for fellow pilgrims, or whose rest and refreshments the general public, under supervision of the Iraqi and Iranian governments, is vying with each other to provide necessary amenities. There are many non-Muslims amongst the marchers to Karbala, such as Christians, Zoroastrians, Buddhists, and Hindus, some of the prominent persons who have come to pay respects to the chief of martyrs are Tushar Gandhi, the great-grandson of the leader of India's freedom struggle against the British, Mahatma Gandhi, who had famously said a century ago that his non-violent movement against colonialism was inspired by Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Another prominent non-Muslim person at this year's Arbaeen in Karbala is Mandla Mandela, the grandson of South Africa's independence from apartheid, Nelson Mandela, who famously said before freedom came, "I have spent more than 20 years in prison. Then on one night, I decided to surrender by signing all the terms and conditions of government. But suddenly, I thought about Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The Karbala movement and Imam Hussein, peace upon him, gave me strength to stand for the right of freedom and liberation, and I did." There are lessons to be learned here for global arrogance and its clients, the unelected and unrepresentative regimes whose media networks deliberately ignored this largest ever annual gathering for their fears that Imam Hussein's message will awaken the masses and mobilize them for rebuilding of the sacred Baqi cemetery in Medina and for the United Muslim campaign to liberate Islam's former Qibla, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Zionist usurped land of Palestine. Hopefully, the day will soon come, similar to the ignominious end of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad. Then only the Ummah will be able to have peace of mind, tranquility of heart, and physical safety and security for fulfilling the humanitarian duties toward making the world a peaceful place to live. Here it is worth recalling that 1,384 years ago in Damascus, when the severed heads of the martyrs of Karbala were placed before him, the godless Yazid, who masqueraded as caliph without having the least faith in Islam, poked a cane in a blasphemous manner at the blessed head of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and exultingly uttered, "A day for a day, this day is in revenge for Badr." This was a reference to the slaying of the pagan maternal grandfather and uncles of his father, the accursed Muawiyah, at the hands of Muslim defenders, especially the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, when they imposed the first ever armed encounter upon Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Yazid, his courtiers and his Umayyad clan members, especially the criminal Marwan ibn Hakam, who later became caliph, thought that their hypocrisy had finally succeeded. By posing as Muslims, like the modern-day ungodly Takfiri terrorists, they thought that they had totally humiliated the Hashemite clan. The eloquently wise sermons of Hazrat Zainab and Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon them, turned the tables on Yazid, compelling him to free the noble Ahlul Bayt, who before returning to Medina visited Karbala to mark the first Arba'in at the unmarked and sun-scorched grave of the immortal martyr who today reposes in the magnificent golden-domed shrine. Today there is no trace of the graves of the Umayyads, let alone their palaces. While Imam Hussein, peace upon him, rules the hearts of the faithful all over the world, as is evident by the millions of devotees who converge upon Karbala from the four cardinal points of the globe, renew their allegiance to his universal mission, while scores of millions of others hold commemoration ceremonies to recount his ideals for defense of humanitarian values in their respective villages, towns, and cities. Let us join the Prophet's loyal companion, Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari, who, despite old age and poor eyesight, made his way from Medina to Iraq in grief on hearing of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and reached Karbala on the day of Arba'in in saluting the chief of martyrs. I bear witness that you kept your promise made with Allah, and strove in his way until what was certain came upon you. So curse of Allah on those who killed you, and curse of Allah on those who oppressed you, and curse of Allah on those who came to know of it and approved it. By the grace of God, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, is indeed watching us and our actions. Since as the noble Quran says in Ayah 169 of Surah Al Imran, "Do not suppose those slain in the way of Allah to be dead. Rather, they are living and provided for near their Lord." Once the great-grandson of the martyr of Karbala, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, was asked by Abdullah ibn Bakr if the grave of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, were to be excavated, will anything be found in it? The sixth Imam replied, "O son of Bakr, how abstruse is your question? Imam Hussein, peace upon him, along with his mother, his father and his brother, Imam Hassan, is in the heavenly house of the Messenger of Allah, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He is living there and receiving his sustenance. If in the early days had his grave been opened, he would have been found there. But now he is alive in the presence of his lord. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, then added, he's watching those who cry for him. He prays for their forgiveness and also requests his ancestors to seek forgiveness for those mourning him. And he says, oh, you mourners, had you known what all I have arranged for you, then you will be more joyous. And all the angels in the skies and in Karbala near him and seek forgiveness for the mourners. Thus, without the least doubt, the Arba'in marches, wherever they are held around the world, and especially on the road leading from Holy Najaf to Holy Karbala, are manifest signs of the unity in diversity of the human race, which without the superficial differences of skin color, class, creed, language, and ethnicity, wants to interact with each other and live in peace, based on the universal mission of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, to sacrifice whatever he had, including life, for the defense of humanitarian values.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Leaders of Palestinian-Lebanese resistance movements have gathered together in Lebanon's capital, Beirut, to discuss a range of issues including anti-Israeli operation by Palestinian groups as well as Tel Aviv threats. The meeting brought together Secretary General of Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, head of the Hamas political office, Saleh al-Aruri, and Secretary General of the Lebanese Hezbollah Movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah. The three leaders exchanged views on latest political developments in the occupied Palestinian territories, as well as recent Israeli threats. The resistance leaders underlined their unwavering and bedrock support for all resistance groups encountering the Israeli occupation. The meeting between resistance leaders comes at a time when tensions are high across the region due to Israeli policies. The occupied Palestinian land, Nablus and Jenin in particular, have been the scene of the regime's raids, resulting in a large number of fatalities. Israeli regime forces attacked Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on July the 3rd, murdering at least 12 Palestinians. They also injured up to 100 others. Some 500 Palestinian families were forced or had to leave their homes due to the Israeli deadly assault. The regime has also carried out numerous raids in the occupied Al-Quds, with settlers backed by Israeli forces killing and injuring Palestinians. Many have described Israeli intention to carry out those raids in the occupied Al-Quds as seeking to tighten the grip on Palestinian people. But Tel Aviv has not sufficed to that. Israeli officials have made numerous comments calling for more pressure against Palestinians. One significant instance was the Israeli far-right minister Etmar Ben-Gavir, who repeatedly called for exerting pressure on Palestinian detainees, which has resulted in inmates languishing in regime jails to start hunger strikes to protest the growing Israeli violence. The The growing Israeli violence in the occupied territories have simply resulted in rising anti-Israeli operations, with stabbing attacks, rocket strikes, and other sorts of operations being reported almost on a daily basis. Those attacks are only in response to calls by resistance leaders to enhance anti-Israeli operations across the occupied land. Such calls have made the regime officials to threaten to assassinate Palestinian resistance leaders, blaming them for the intensification of resistance against Tel Aviv. Palestinian Hamas movement has reaffirmed that Tel Aviv's threats to assassinate resistance leaders will lead to a confrontation and that the regime will pay its price. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has echoed Hamas' warning, stressing that Israeli threats will only increase Palestinian people and fighters' determination to adhere to the option of resistance in words, actions, and behavior, and to insist on responding to any crime the Israeli regime plans to commit. Additionally, the spokesperson for the Palestinian Freedom Movement, Yasser Khalaf, said that such threats do not frighten the Palestinian people and will not impact the strategy of enhancing and developing the resistance strength and performance. He sent a message to the Israeli leaders not to make wrong calculations regarding the situation, as what awaits them will be far greater than expected. Those calls have been reiterated by Said Hassan Nasrallah, who just recently said that Israel will be returned to the Stone Age if it goes to war with Lebanon. Taking a brief look at those remarks, what they all have in common is that Palestinian resistance is determined to stand firm against Israeli atrocities. This also shows that the resistance has expanded beyond the occupied territories and will continue to expand day after day to the extent which can endanger the future of Israeli occupying regime. Anti-French sentiment is high in Niger as thousands gathered outside the French military base in the capital Niamey to demand the withdrawal of French forces and its ambassadors from the African country. Wearing and waving Niger's flag, demonstrators chanted anti-French slogan, expressing their full support for the country's military government. The demonstrators demanded that Western countries, especially France, respect their choice.
Not our sole demand.
Our only request, our ultimate request, is the departure of the French who are on Niger territory. We don't need these people here. We don't need, and we repeat, we are ready to die to defend our homeland. We are ready to die to get them out. They must leave. We don't need them here.
We're here and we'll be here forever, until the day France packs up, and packs up it will, I tell you. France has to move out because it's not its country. It's our country, it's our territory, and well, France has to move out.
The anger in Niger grew especially after the French president said his country did not recognize the military government there. Emmanuel Macron has said he's in regular contact with Niger's deposed president Mohamed Bazoum. Nigerian junta has blasted Macron's comments, saying their remarks constitute blatant interference in their domestic affairs. But regardless of those reactions, the European Union said it was imposing sanctions against the military junta in Niger as part of efforts to force its leaders to hand over power to a civilian rule.
We have also decided to initiate a process for the establishment of a legal framework for individual sanctions against the putschists, and we are ready to listen to other suggestions from ECOWAS. They explained to us the situation on the ground and how ECOWAS is considering the possibility of a military deployment on the ground.
And instead of expressing support for the people of Niger, who have been under the French colonial rule for decades, Borrell expressed a bloc solidarity with Paris.
The ministers reiterated the strong condemnation of the military coup in Niger, called for the release of President Bazoum and his family, and to go back to the constitutional order. This is something that has been involving, in particular, France. We express our solidarity with France.
The anger and resentment in Niger comes as the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, under the direct influence of France, has threatened to deploy military force in the West African nation in an effort to reinstate ousted President Bazoum. That after the military junta took power following a coup on July 26 and placed President Bazoum under house arrest in what many described as an anti-French revolution in Niger. But what is the root cause of all that hatred against France? Over the years, Niger has faced growing insecurity amid worsening effects of political instability and armed insurgencies. At the same time, the West African nation, a resource-rich country of 26 million, is, according to UN figures, considered one of the poorest nations on Earth. Given that the French have been playing a crucial role in Niger, both politically and economically, the general public points its finger at Paris to be the cause of all its grievances. But Niger is not the only country facing growing anti-French sentiment. The hatred against France has been a common feeling amongst many African countries, given that the military takeover in Niger is the sixth in the Sahel region in less than 3 years, coming after Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali. The toppling of President Bazoum has, in a way, created shockwaves not only across Africa, but reverberated across Europe. That's due to the fact that Niger is home to its strategic mineral reserves, such as uranium, gold, and crude oil, among others. The interesting point, though, is that France holds mineral rights for the mining of uranium, which powers its nuclear power plant. This has made Paris highly depend on Niger's uranium mines. But being aware of the strategic importance of uranium to France's energy needs, Niger military leaders have already announced that they will suspend the export of uranium and gold to France and the United States. The move is widely seen by many across Niger as a way to cut the hands of powers that have long been plundering the country's resources. Knowing that the same fate would be waiting for many across other Sahelian countries, African people are waking up to the fact that Western powers, namely France, have been maintaining their presence in their countries merely to plunder their resources. That's maybe the reason for Nigerians and other West African countries to come to the fact that the era of colonialism is over and they are the ones who should put an end to the decades of West's occupation and economic exploitation of their countries.
It's a plot out of a Hollywood movie, but with serious repercussions. The shadow war between Israel and Iran. This one involves an Israeli plot to sabotage Iran's defense industry, including missiles, the biggest military sabotage attempt against Iran in the past 100 years. It is one that failed, however, just in the nick of time. The agency's statement reveals the scope of the operation. The intelligence unit of the Defense Ministry thwarted one of the largest sabotage plots targeting Iran's missile, aviation, and aerospace military industry. This sabotage was carried out under the guidance of the Zionist intelligence services and their agents. A network of agents sought to introduce defective parts into the production of advanced missiles, specifically defective connectors from abroad. The defective parts were discovered by the Defense Ministry Information Protection. The plan was to equip these connectors with explosive circuits. If that was done successfully, the connectors could be programmed to explode remotely at any time. But how was this plot unfoiled?
بله ایشون یک فرد در واقع غیر نظامی بود خب در همین شبکه خرید که شرکت هایی که کار میکرد و ایشون
ایرانی؟
خودش بله ایرانی بود خودش حساس میشه به این که چرا مثلا اون طرف خارجی و اونایی که دارن به ایشون این قطعات رو میفروشن این میاد مثلا داخل توزیع میکنه چرا حساس شدن حتی اینها بررسی میکردن توی بازار خرید داخل مراکزی که توزیع کننده این قطعات بودن اطلاعات جمع‌آوری میکردن و ایشون حساس میشه میاد با همکارای ما در سازمان حفاظت اطلاعات در میون میذاره و همکارا چون اطلاعات دیگری هم داشتن بله. که یک علائمی رو از قبل به دست آورده بودن اینها رو تقاطع اطلاعاتی میدن با تقاطع اطلاعاتی و با کمک ایشون بقیه شبکه کم کم تحت شناسایی قرار میگیره، منتها به گونه ای که به هیچ وجه موساد و سرویس رژیم صهیونیستی متوجه این اشرافیت اطلاعاتی ایران نشد.
Under the false pretext of preventing Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, Mossad has been carrying out a campaign of sabotage and cyber attacks on Iran's civilian nuclear program for quite some time. One of the notorious ones was the Stuxnet virus. In April 2011, Iranian government official Ghulam Reza Jalali stated that an investigation had concluded that both the United States and Israel were behind the Stuxnet attack. Mossad has also methodically assassinated and murdered Iranian nuclear scientists, from magnetic bombs attached to the side of their cars, to the use of poison, and allegedly the use of a killer robot remotely used as an assassin. Additionally, Israel has also targeted Iran's nuclear facilities. Israel's targeting of Iran's defense industry, in particular its drones and missile program, does make sense from Israel's point of view. Iran has made extraordinary advancements in these two fields and military hardware overall. But all of these destructive actions, which Israel has not claimed responsibility for, has not been able to stop Iran's advancements. From Israel's perspective, it makes strategic sense, though only a temporary fix. There's an Iranian saying that says, "Don't play with the lion's tail." Iran may have thwarted these acts of sabotage, but for how long will its patience last when it comes to Israel?
Russia has warned that the West's approval of Ukraine's attacks on Crimea could set the stage for a disastrous war between Moscow and Kiev's Western allies. The warning has been issued by the deputy chairman of Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev. The former Russian president has warned any green light to Ukraine's attacks on Crimea entitles Moscow to take action against, quote, each and every NATO member. He added that such an approval would be considered direct legal evidence of the West's complicity in the war against Russia. Medvedev's comments came after a senior Ukrainian official said Washington supports strikes on Crimea if Kiev deems them necessary. Mikhail Podolyak, senior advisor to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, has also said there is absolute consensus amongst Western countries that Kiev can destroy anything that belongs to Russia in territories taken by Moscow. Medvedev has repeatedly warned Kiev that Moscow would have to use a nuclear weapon if Ukrainian forces set foot on Russian territory. Medvedev has said if the West truly supports what Mikhail Podolyak says, it would signal an apocalyptic risk of the end of the world. Moscow has said that the collective West is waging a proxy war against the Russian nation, with the Ukrainian troops under Kiev's command merely providing the cannon fodder for the conflict.
Here you have one country which has 100 million more people than the other country and has much deeper military industrial capacity, can make more missiles, make more bullets, make more tanks than the other country. So over time, the bigger country is almost certain to win, correct? This is a physics principle. Right. It's not a statement of allegiance. You're not a shill for somebody for acknowledging that. If we're wrestling and you outweigh me by 100 pounds, you're probably going to win because you're bigger. That's a fact.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration is working to reach a deal with Ukraine for long-term military support to keep backing the war with Russia. According to media reports, the commitments would make it difficult for a future president to exit. The effort is part of a commitment made by G7 nations at the recent NATO summit in Vilnius to negotiate their own bilateral security deals with Ukraine. Besides the G7 nations, 18 other countries have agreed to provide long-term military support for Kiev.
The United States, NATO, and the EU are on the wrong path. And at the very most, it could lead to their destruction. And at the very least, it will destroy the euro. It will destroy the dollar. It will destroy the Western economy.
Reports say Western officials are looking for ways to lock in pledges of support and limit future governments' abilities to backtrack amid fears in European capitals that Donald Trump, if he recaptures the White House, will seek to scale back the aid. The United States has announced $250 million in fresh military aid to Ukraine. The package is said to include equipment for clearing mines and obstacles, as well as missiles, artillery rounds, anti-armor missiles, and more than 3 million rounds of small arms ammunition. Kiev has already received more than $43 billion US dollars from the US in the form of weapon systems like howitzers and millions of rounds of ammunition, including widely banned cluster munitions since last February when Russia started a special military operation in Ukraine. The flow of arms to Ukraine has raised concerns in some European capitals. Former Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte has said NATO's strategy regarding the conflict in Ukraine has not led to the outcome desired by the alliance, and the economic sanctions imposed on Russia have not crippled its economy. According to Conte, the strategy pursued so far in NATO, based on constant military supplies to Ukraine and the logic of escalation, did not lead to a military defeat for Russia. The US and its allies have pledged to give Ukraine F-16 fighter jets, but military experts now believe jets are not going to be a silver bullet for Kiev.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى و دین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله اقرأ بسم ربك الذي خلق
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا
او زد عليه ورتل القران ترتيلا
قد عودتك ربي بقراني جنبني حراني
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك ارجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا احسان ودعوتك ربي بقراني
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرج
السلام عليكم respected brothers and sisters dear عليكم السلام ورحمة الله dear listeners welcome to IRIB English Radio here is Brother Hussein Akbari with me, and I'm very glad, I'm very happy that Alhamdulillah I have him with us today, and we hope that inshallah you stay with us till the end of this session. I say hello to Hussein in this session. Salam Hussein, how are you?
Thank you.
Welcome to our program. Brothers and sisters, inshallah today we'll be working on Ayah 159 of Surah An-Nisa. So, it's a very important topic. Inshallah, we'll talk about this. Before we start, Hussein, inshallah, we'll go and listen to the recitation, then we'll come back. Ready?
Yes.
Okay, let's go.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa in min ahlil kitabi illa layu'minanna bihi qabla mawtihi. وَيَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ يَكُونُ عَلَيْهِمْ شَهِيدًا
MashaAllah, nice recitation. Allah bless the reciter. So, Hussein, Allah Almighty in Ayah 159 says, بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ وَإِن مِّنْ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ إِلَّا لَيُؤْمِنَنَّ بِهِ قَبْلَ مَوْتِهِ وَيَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ يَكُونُ عَلَيْهِمْ Shahida. So Hussein, you know that Prophet Isa alayhi salam was taken to the heaven. Okay, Allah Almighty took him, to the heaven. Then towards himself. Actually raised. Allah Almighty raised him up towards himself. And in Ayah 159 we have this Bal Rafa'ahu Allahu ilayh. Then Allah Almighty says there is none among the people of the book. You can't find anyone among the people of the book, but will surely believe in him before his death. They thought that Prophet Isa had died because he was killed, he was crucified. Actually, they believed, okay, in Prophet Isa. But now they have kind of false beliefs, and they believe that Allah Almighty is has sent him as a prophet, okay?
Okay.
And he is not the son of God. So, but unfortunately, okay, they were like opposite. They were also pretending. They kind of expressing their beliefs in a wrong way. They were saying that Prophet Isa is the son of God and he's the God of son, okay, and Allah is the God of father and these kind of things they believed, which were completely wrong beliefs. Okay. Then Prophet Isa alayhi salam in the day of judgment will be a witness against them. And Prophet Isa alayhi salam will confess that, oh, people of the book, you were doing this, you were doing this, and you were not believing in God correctly, the correct way. And after even I was raised toward Allah Almighty, then Prophet Isa will be as a witness and will say there. Okay.
Okay.
So this is what Allah Almighty says in this ayah. I hope I have given the points which were necessary. So let me read once the translation. There is none among the people of the book. وَإِن مِّنْ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ إِلَّا لَيُؤْمِنَنَّ بِهِ قَبْلَ مَوْتِهِ But will surely believe in him before his death. And وَيَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ يَكُونُ عَلَيْهِمْ شَهِيدًا And in the day of judgment, Prophet Isa alayhi salam will be a witness against them. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah. So one of the messages of this ayah, I will say, then we'll go towards the tajweed rules and the recitation. Hussein, One of the points is actually this, that death is something, it's a fact, okay?
Yes.
Everyone will die one day.
Okay.
And this is a fact. You can't deny this. We will experience it sooner or later. We'll experience it. But the thing is that before we die, we must do something with our belief, with our iman, with our Islam, okay? That we should believe in God or not. We should think about it, okay? We should think about it. So this is the thing that we understand. After the death, yeah, when you died, you will be, like, you will have no way to deny, okay?
Okay.
Because you die and you experience it. So it is really good if you believe it at the very first time when you are alive. Okay, when you have chance, when you have time.
الذين يذكرون الله قياما وقعودا وعلى جنوبهم.
If you see the Holy Quran in Surah Muzammil, ayat number 20, Allah Tabarak wa Ta'ala says, and recite as much as possible from the Quran. As much as possible.
رَبَّنَا رَبَّنَا مَا خَلَقْتَ هَذَا.
That's why they say one of the beauties of the eloquence of the fasahat and balaghat of the Quran is that whenever you open the Quran, it's as if it speaks to you today very, very clearly.
The Quran is a covenant of God for His creature. It is misaq. It is covenant for His servants. It is necessary for the Muslims to read this covenant and recite 50 words every day.
So, Hussein, let's go to the recitation, okay?
Okay.
So, first, for the recitation, actually, we need to learn the tajweed rules. So, Hussein, I want you to read this ayah once. Hussein, read. A'udhu billah. Read it.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah.
Good, good.
Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. وَإِنْ مِنْ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ إِلَّا لَيُؤْمِنَنَّ بِهِ قَبْلَ مَوْتِهِ وَيَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ يَكُونُ عَلَيْهِمْ شَهِيدًا.
Superb. MashaAllah. MashaAllah, Hussein. Allah bless you. That was great. Perfect. MashaAllah. Okay. So let's talk about the tajweed rules. وَإِنْ, then we have مِنْ, نُن, and مِمْ. We join them. وَإِمْ. Right? نُن ساكين.
Yes.
Plus mim, the rule, idgham ikhfa, which one?
Idgham.
Idgham, mashallah. Idgham is applied here. Wa'im, wa'im, wa'im min ahli al-kitabi. Right? Wa'im, then min ahli, min ahli, nun sakin plus hamza. What rule is applied? Idhar, iqlab, which one? Idgham.
Idgham.
Idhar here.
Uh-huh. Idhar, yeah.
No changes. Wa'im min ahl. Min ahl. Quickly, fast. Wa'im min ahl. Not min ahl, no. Or mi ahl, no. Wa'im min ahlil kitabi. Alright? Then, illa la yu'minanna. Nun with tashdid. Idgham, yes? لا يؤمنن إدغام غنة إدغام with غنة مينن. Alright, so به ها, you extend the sound he, not he, he. Read it
به
أحسن به قبل موته قبل ب. What rule is applied?
قبل
قبل قلقله. Is that right? Yes. قلقله.
Yes.
قبل. إلا ليؤمنن به قبل موته. قبل موته. So, Hussein, there is a small sign called Sila on the top, and that says that you can continue and you can stop. But it's better to continue, yes?
Yes.
Okay. So, it's better to continue. So, if we continue, قَبْلَ مَوْتِهِ again, if we join them, if we continue reading, قَبْلَ مَوْتِهِ وَيَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ يَكُونُ عَلَيْهِمْ شَهِيدًا. شَهِيدًا?
No.
Changes to شَهِيدَ.
Da.
Good job. تَنْوِين فَتْحَة. Whenever we stop at the end of the word, it changes to Alif Mad. Shaheedan changes to Shaheeda.
Da.
Ahsan. So, Hussein, we learned the very important Tajweed rules in this ayah. I'm going to read. You should repeat after me. Ready, Hussein?
Yes.
Okay. A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
أحسنتم. Brothers and sisters, as you're listening, inshallah, practice with us. We are practicing ayah 159 of Surah An-Nisa. So, بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
ما شاء الله. Bravo, Hussein. ما شاء الله. وإن من أهل الكتاب إلا ليؤمنن به قبل موته
وإن من أهل الكتاب إلا ليؤمنن به قبل موته.
أحسنتم ما شاء الله. قبل موته.
قبل.
أحسن. ويوم القيامة يكون عليهم شهيدا.
ويوم القيامة يكون عليهم شهيدا.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. أحسنتم. Thank you so much, dear Hussein. Brothers and sisters, I really thank you so much for being with us till the end of this session. And inshallah, we hope you stay with IRB English Radio for the next and coming sessions. We'll be inshallah practicing the next verses of Surah An-Nisa. Hope you stay safe. May Allah protect you all from all kinds of evils. And thank you so much. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi Muhammad
wa ajjil faraj.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
وصفاته نبع الهدى نرقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان
A walk towards a perfect world.
part 3.
In this very spirit, pictures and stories of martyrs killed for fighting injustice for the sake of Allah are spread out across the walk. Some mawqifs even specifically focus on these personalities to inspire others. It is clear that the Arba'in walk has many different elements, including peace, love, humanity, forgiveness, sacrifice, selflessness, and Islamic activism. Lots and lots of opportunities for someone to perfect themselves through this journey towards Imam Hussein. But how can one take full advantage of this experience in just a few days?
There are a number of things that somebody can do in order to take full advantage of the Arba'in walk. And in fact, we could look at it this perspective, that however much we get the opportunity to perform the Arba'in walk, each time can be an effort to try to gain more and more of it. Because I do believe that however much somebody takes from it, there's even more that they can take the next time around. Part of the way to be able to get that benefit is by observing the adab of the walk. There's certain etiquette that can be practiced. Things like making sure that somebody is in the state of constant remembrance of Allah Ta'ala, also in particular in remembrance of the one or the ones that they're going to be visiting, by taking care of their fellow zuwar, by treating them with a lot of respect, not pushing, allowing them to pass, for example, by not being overly engaged with like the sights and the sounds and the different offerings that are being given along the walk, by trying to walk in with a demeanor that somebody is, you know, going towards something great. And that means that, for example, trying to keep the head a little bit more down, and trying to walk in a dignified manner. Also by not engaging in worldly sort of discussions, and trying to keep in the state of wudu as well. And a few others that are mentioned, it's worth studying this thing and to see what is it that the ulama have recommended, what type of adhkar and what type of remembrance of Allah did the great scholars like Sayyid Qadi Tabatabai perform when they went on the walk. These are things that we should research and ask the scholars and try to find out. If you look at the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, they talk about the reward of walking to perform ziyarah and how much reward each footstep can bear for the person who's performing them. It's tremendous. And there's something that the Ahlul Bayt wanted for us to achieve. So trying to make sure that we understand that perspective. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? Whom am I going to see? The more that we understand the position of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, the more our ma'rifah increases and our awareness increases, then the more that the walk will have meaning. But of course, in order to understand the position of the Ahlul Bayt, we have to understand the position of Allah Ta'ala, and consequently the position of Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. And then we can start to begin to understand the position of the Ahlul Bayt. But even that, of course, is at a certain rudimentary level. And we hope that by virtue of the ziyarah, that the true knowledge will be given to us about the position of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. So by number one, observing the adab, and number two, increasing our awareness and ma'arifah of what we're doing, why we're doing it, and whom we're going to visit.
Why is it important to visit him? What makes this event so, so important? Its relationship with ourselves as individuals, ourselves as an ummah, and all humanity, both the past and the future, right? And I think something that we should think about while taking part in this amazing journey is to try to find our role in the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. When we enter the shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, it shouldn't only be an empty salam. It shouldn't only be an expression of emotion about what happened in the past, but rather it should be an expression of devotion and of resolution that I will do everything I can to make sure that your movement continues and reaches the entire world.
Don't make touching the shrine your purpose, which is, I think, something that we often fall into. It's a trap that we often fall into. It's not a mission for you to touch the shrine. Even if you stand outside and you say salam, but you say it with khulus, then I'd say that you have reached to an extent making the most of your trip here. Your trip here is supposed to take whatever you have become so far and push yourself to the limit. Recognize that you're here surrounded by people from all over the world, and learn from their experiences. Learn from what they have gone through in life. Many of us, when we come here, we stay in hotels. Many of us who come here don't have that luxury. When you are walking amongst these people, you need to try, and I'm speaking to myself before anybody else out there, you need to try to see yourself as part of them. It's as if we're all blood vessels, and every path, every literal road full of people leading to the shrine of Imam Hussein is like a vein. And you can see the hadith of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam materializing here, because he said that the ummah is like a body. If one part of it aches, the rest of it will also, you know, they'll stay awake out of fever and unrest until that part of the body is healed. Many of the people who come here in for Arba'een, they're suffering. They are oppressed people. And I think one of the ways to take full advantage of this trip is to recognize the trials and tribulations of our fellow mu'mineen out there in the world, and to be touched by them. Many people, they say, will walk in and out of your heart, but only a true friend will leave footsteps. Allow the people on this path to leave footprints in your heart.
The only power that's able to make this happen is love. Is love. It's only one thing which makes Arba'een happen, which makes this walk happen, and that's love. Pure, true love. If you want to experience that love, you have to come for Arba'een.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."